52 DR Oshkosh and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The Pentagon tracking a huge spy balloon from China that's flying over the U.S. A defense official saying they believe the balloon has limited value for intelligence collection. The Northeast about to get hit by an Arctic blast, and Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey is asking residents to be proactive.
I would encourage the public to look after your neighbors, check on those who are vulnerable, particularly our seniors, but anyone you know who may be vulnerable in this time.
Dangerous wind chills likely. Russian missiles striking residential areas in eastern Ukraine. House lawmakers stripping Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar of her seat on the Foreign Affairs Committee over anti-Semitic comments made in 2019. Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
We're not removing her from other committees. We just do not believe when it comes to foreign affairs, especially the responsibility of that position around the world with the comments that you make. She shouldn't serve there.
This is ABC News. President Biden's top economic advisor, Brian Deese, is stepping down. He helped craft major economic policy, including the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act. One Ohio high school has canceled a play deemed too vulgar.
The musical is the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. Production was underway at Cardinal High School in Middlefield, Ohio, when the superintendent canceled the show, saying in a statement that dialogue and song lyrics contain vulgarity and aren't suitable for kids in an educational setting. But many think the issue is that one of the characters has gay dads.
I'm heartbroken for you.
Modern Family star Jesse Tyler Ferguson was part of the original Broadway cast, posting a video on social media showing support for the school play, and the show's creators have said there's a version of the script with clean language. Jason Athenson, ABC News. Hollywood.
There's so much demand for Beyoncé's upcoming tour that she's adding 7 North American stadium shows. Live Nation says fan demand already exceeds the number of available tickets by more than 800%. Andy Field, ABC News.
Fox Valley regional and state news and commentary for us to find common ground. Civic Media.
Your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected on the Civic Media Network, civicmedia.us.
From the Civic Media News Desk, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Jennifer Durrow's first radio ads are on the air, touting her stewardship of the Waukesha Christmas Parade trial. No word on how much she's spending. Janet Protasewicz launched a $700,000 TV ad campaign last week, and a group called Fair Courts America is spending $240,000 on radio ads urging support for Dan Kelly. The Wisconsin Supreme Court primary is the 21st. A man from Northwest Wisconsin gets 30 years in prison for beating another man to death with a hammer last year. It happened last March in Osceola. Firefighters found the victim's body in a burning mobile home. A Polk County judge handed down the sentence this week. In sports, Marquette beat Villanova last night 64-73. The Bucks host the Clippers tonight, and the Badgers are at Ohio State. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Frog in a pot of boiling water and it'll jump right out. But put a frog in a pot of cool water and slowly heat it up, that frog will boil. As a metaphor for us and all that we go through as veterans, it's a story that rings true. We learn to endure the heat in silence. We apply what we learn to life, the bills, the job, the family, things we're expected to handle with ease. When life heats up around us, we just try to stay afloat. We let the water boil, Reaching out isn't easy, but you've never been interested in easy. You join because you are not afraid of hard work. You are not a frog. If you or a veteran you know needs support, don't wait until the water boils. Reach out. Find resources at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach. Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
I'm Chris Jakimick. I served in the United States Air Force, and I deployed 3 times. So in 2017, I was serving as an Air Force First Sergeant. Our motto in that role is, my job is people, everyone is my business. But unfortunately, in that year, I would lose my own brother, Lance Corporal Adam Jakimick, to suicide. The majority of veteran suicides are from guns. I store my weapons securely, not only for myself, but for my family. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide. My service never stops.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Keeping the Fox Valley connected, informed, and entertained. This is Civic Media.
From Green Bay to Oshkosh and Point South, wherever you are in the Fox Valley, count on us to keep you connected, informed, and entertained. Civic.
To think who to hate and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the Fed raised the interest rates again, and look, you know, I've been saying for a while, it appears to me, and look, I'm just a dumb truck driver, appears to me that the forces to be in the Federal Reserve by aggressively raising rates and saying they're going to raise them again down the road, they want the spur on this recession. You've got Republicans in the House, you know, holding the country hostage over the debt ceiling, seems to want to bring on a massive recession. You look on all the social media apps and all of these prognosticators and all of these pundits saying Armageddon's coming and it's coming in the summer, like they're wishing and hoping and wanting the kind of chaos that, well, the Fed and Republicans seem to be heading us towards. And you go, why? Well, I've been saying for a while, it's to crush workers and put them back in their place. But I've decided to ask somebody who probably knows a lot more about this than I do. That's why I've asked my good friend Mateus Vernango to come talk with us. He's a professor of economics at Bucknell University. You can check out his website, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Good stuff there. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So am I getting this right? I'm looking at the fact that the Fed again raised interest rates, not as aggressively as they did before, but a 0.25% is a pretty good jump. I'm looking at what's going on in the House with this debt ceiling hostage situation. It just seems to me like the forces to be want to cause chaos. If it's not to crush workers who are asking for better wages, it's to make Biden look bad. I'm curious what you're seeing.
I would agree with you. You can come and teach. Don't feel that you don't know what's going on. I think you have a good handle of what's going on. So we'll invite you for a visiting position at Bucknell. That's spot on. I think that I would differentiate a little bit between the Fed and Powell and Republicans in Congress in the following things. So I think the Fed wants to cause they may say that they want a soft landing, meaning that they want to stop inflation without causing a recession. The truth is that the downside for the Fed, if they cause a recession in comparison to, say, they cannot stop inflation, although they're not stopping inflation, stop by itself. At this point, I should say, if you look at the last 6 months of inflation, not the annualized inflation, which is what they show, and the annualized is whatever it is, 6-something or 5-something, but the last 6 months, the annualized inflation is around the target of 2%. So inflation stopped because the price of commodities, oil, energy commodities sort of stopped going up. There are some things like eggs and whatnot, things in the news, but for the most part, inflation stopped. But the downside for the Fed, if they look weak on inflation, is terrible. On the other hand, if there is a recession, not a big deal. I mean, financial markets will be okay with that, because what they want to do is stop wages and put the labor class back in its place. The Republicans in Congress, it's more complicated. I think that they want really chaos. It may very well cause the recession. If the Fed already didn't cause a recession, I think that the jury is still out on that. And I think it's very possible that the effects of the interest rates on the housing market that are already visible may, you know, throw us in a recession, and that's already inevitable. But let's say we dodge that bullet and we don't fall into a recession because of the Fed. Then I think Republicans want to throw us in a recession, and then I think it's political, not just, to mess with the working class. I think they also want, the 20 Republicans that, the whole thing with McCarthy, they if they prove something, is that this group is capable of perhaps for the first time creating a situation in which we not just shut down the government, but actually default on that by not raising the ceiling. I have no inside information on this.
No, there's no inside information. I truly believe they want to shoot the hostage. I think
it's very likely that they want, and they prove that they are willing to do it.
It's one of these things that, it's like you tell a kid don't touch the hot stove. You keep telling them don't touch the hot stove, bad things will happen. They got to touch the hot stove to find out what the bad thing is. I believe there are people who are in the house who are going, well, what's the worst thing can happen? So what, we default on it? We print the money? What's the big deal? So let's walk through this idea then for a little bit, because I've actually had people say, well, so what? What if we default? What if we don't pay any of it back? What's the worst thing that happens?
Well, it has happened in countries like Argentina when you don't pay foreign debt in general. I mean, countries don't tend to do this to their own currencies. Yeah, in their own currencies, countries normally don't have limits on the ability to spend in their own currency. Normally, Argentina is on the verge of a default, and we defaulted, God knows exactly how many times. But it's on debt in dollars, and we don't print dollars. What happens with that is that, the economy collapses. So Argentina, the GDP collapses, was 20% when last time it happened in 2002. If you go to Greece, Greece uses the euro and defaulted in euros, so it never quite defaulted. I should say they always arrange a thing, but it was very similar. But they don't control the euro because essentially that's the European Central Bank. So they are in the hands of a foreign central bank. And GDP is now 14 years past the crisis in 2010, and it started in 2008, 22-23% below its peak, the GDP. So imagine shrinking the economy 20% and staying for a whole decade and a half in there. That's what we're talking about. I mean, these people are insane. This is not fun. Italy, that never defaulted, but it's in the same grip of the euro. People ask me, last week Argentina and Brazil talked about a common currency, said, it's a terrible idea because you lose your ability to fund yourself in your own currency. And Italy, that, has not defaulted. It's still below what it was before the crisis, 12 years ago. So those are the reasons why you don't want to default. Their inability to pay. I mean, we stop the size of the U.S. federal government is humongous. Think of what we do if we stop, let alone all the other things that U.S. represents globally. The U.S. is, for good or for bad, still we spend 10 times what the next one spends, in the military. So the consequences for U.S. abroad are inimaginable. So it is difficult to wrap our heads around what they're trying to do. And again, they want to see in Portuguese we say the to see this circus barn. They're gonna get it. They're gonna have it is inimaginable to me that we're gonna do that. But I think you're right. And then so it's not a recession. You see, the danger of that, it's much more complicated than just a mere recession. This would be something unprecedented.
Again, another created crisis, which they're masterful at doing. But you brought up Greece a second ago, and a lot of my conservative friends love to point to Greece and say the United States is going to be just like Greece because we have, about 120% debt to GDP ratio right now. Greece was something like 600-700, if I remember right. We're not really Greece, but they love to use that as the example. How bad is our debt problem?
we don't have a debt problem. That's the issue. So Greece has a debt problem because they have a it's in euros, and the German and French elites decided that they're not going to pay for the catching up of Greece, or the Greek working class, let alone not even the Greek, the German and the French working class. They're trying to stiff the German and the French working class, let alone let the Greek or the Italian working class have a decent living standards. So it's not the case in the United States. The 120%, whatever it is, 30 something trillion dollars, and GDP is 24, whatever it is. So it's not so huge amount depends on your ability to pay. We have no problem of paying this debt. There is no significant problem of paying the debt in your own currency. There is ability to raise funds. If you think along those lines, we can raise taxes on the wealthy. There are many things that can be done. Even things when it's the same logic as, for example, people talk about the Social Security. We're broke. We cannot pay. Of course, we can pay. There are many ways in which this can be solved. We can extend, Social Security taxes to people that make more money, which we're
not going to do.
Reason. Yes, I know it's political, but that's a political decision. So. But the other thing that I always want to remind people of, so think of this. It's a graph I always show in class. The English economy between 1750 and 1850 had always more than 100% debt to GDP ratio. At the peak, which was during the Napoleonic Wars, 1815 or so, it's around 260% of GDP, 260%. And I always ask kids, what happened between 1750 and 1850? And it takes them a while. But there is always, thank God, somebody that says the Industrial Revolution. So the biggest change since the Agricultural Revolution in the history of humanity that leads to modernity and the rise of England to be the hegemonic country around the world, the most powerful country that they've seen up to that point, it's done on a pile of debt. The problem with that is not the debt per se, it's how you use the debt.
Right.
And so the problem I have with the 120% debt, and people say it's excessive. Well, it's excessive depending for what? If you're asking me, for having the kind of services that the working class and the people have, the health that we have, for having the kinds of schools that we have, yes, we're expending too much. But can we have this kind of spending and use it to provide decent standards of living for the working class? Of course we can. So that's part of the problem, how we're using the debt, not that we are accumulating it. So incurring in the debt to go to college, I always tell them it's a good idea. But if you don't get a good job and cannot repay it, that's the problem. So right. If you use the money, the debt, to build an infrastructure, to be competitive, to give good working, good jobs to working class people, what's the problem with the debt? There's nothing wrong. We can pay it back. Why? Because we're having productive jobs. We're creating the income that will create the taxes that will pay back eventually, the debt that was accumulated. There is no problem with that. The dynamic of that is easy to understand. And, it's as simple as the rate of growth of the economy has to be higher than the rate of interest on the debt you're accumulating. It's as simple as that. And that's doable. By the way, the Fed can help and control the interest rate on long-term bonds of U.S. government. So if they work together, there should be no reason why you should be broke in your own currency. So we are not Greece in that sense. What I'm saying is, if we decided to do what the Greek were forced to do because we're stupid, pardon my French, then, sure, we're going to have a catastrophe. But is it necessary to cut that? So in the Greek case, it was a Greek tragedy. It was inevitable. It was out of their hands. I think that the left government of Syriza tried to get away from that. They couldn't. The Germans said no. We don't have that. We have just 20 Republicans, perhaps more, if McCarthy goes with the crazies, that are taking the government hostage and may take it to, and by the way, Biden is right in saying that we shouldn't negotiate. There's no reason for austerity and for cutting spending because of the debt ceiling. There is no reason to do that. So
there's not.
I think Biden is absolutely correct.
But here's the thing. I mean, and I had someone explain this to me the other day that I wanted to get your perspective on, because they're saying, well, all this inflation, it's Biden inflation, and everyone's blaming Joe Biden. And I'm going, this is a moment that kind of a historical kind of anomaly. I mean, we're coming out of a massive recession. You know, the demand was kind of pent up. And it's kind of just like after World War II. This person was explaining to me after World War II, there was kind of there was inflation because, you know, we went from a war economy to a production economy. And I remember my grandparents talking about, you know, the boom that was the early 50s and that. But we handled it differently. There was massive government spending on housing and massive government spending on education. There was massive investment that helped offset that. There were strong labor unions that raised, that skyrocketed wages. We're not doing those things now.
No. And also this, you know, the recovery, although was fast, you know, we're not even close to, you know, I mean, the amount of, so during the Second World War, inflation was caused by too much demand. You know, there was, you know, the fiscal deficit of the government was of the order of 45% of GDP. We have nothing comparable to that. You know, I mean, people are exaggerating. So this inflation, the inflation is gone. As I said, if you look at the annualized inflation over the last 6 months, it's gone. Inflation is going to be gone. I know that people haven't felt it yet, but in the numbers, it's already gone. And the Fed knows that. I mean, if I know it, you know, you can be sure that the Fed knows this. So the inflation is not. No, I don't think inflation will linger for too long, unless again something happens. The war in Ukraine will continue, so God knows what will happen. You know, but there are many things that helped. For example, the good summer in the winter. The winter is not too cold, and you know, so the price of energy didn't go too much up in Europe. That helps us, and so there are many things that have helped so far. So inflation will not get out of hand. Inflation is only bad. People have to think of why you're trying to solve a problem. Inflation is only bad because it hurts people at the bottom of the income distribution. And so if you want to solve that problem, increase the wages of the relatively poor, you know, and that's the way of solving. Let's increase the minimum wage.
No, let's absolutely. No, I tell the story all the time.
That's the way to start with solving those problems. So I don't think that, you know, that's the issue. But I don't think also that we're not doing the investment and all of those things because of Biden even called his, you know, build back better or whatever it was the name. It was sort of a discussion of, you know, they gave it the name to whatever ended up happening, the anti-inflation sort of, you know, package. So they see this as a package to fight those, you know, supply side snags that allowed prices to go up. But I think that, you know, we're not going to do anything of like that, because that would be, you know, given Democrats, and in particular the sort of more progressive strand of the Democrats that have been asking for something like a new deal for a while, a very strong argument. The issue that transformed, I think, the U.S. in the 40s and 50s and 60s, up to the 60s, you know, when things again got more complicated politically, was that it was so evident that the effort for the war that was brought by the government and that was an extension of the New Deal did work. If you give, you know, and the government spends humongous amounts and goes and spends and gives people housing, education, the GI Bill, you know, and all of those things get better. And, you know, and that's a dangerous thing. And that's a dangerous thing. So I think that they don't want that kind of thing to happen.
But Mateus, that's socialism. And today we had a vote in the House to say we will take no forms of socialism.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good debate. So, you know, it's I spend time, you know, nobody knows who Keynes is anymore. But I spend a good time, you know, Keynes is the sort of thinker of all of these ideas that we connect, British thinker connected to all of these ideas in the New Deal and whatnot to some extent. And somebody said, oh, he was a socialist. I said, no, he was a liberal. What happened is that socialists at some point became Keynesians. And so they adopted this idea that government intervention can actually... Keynes' notion was we can save capitalism from itself. So we don't have to be socialist and communist. What we can do is go out and spend, and the government can provide all of the things while you still have a private sector that it's, you know, independent, thriving, and, you know, you have the private enterprise that still dominates the economy, but in a mixed economy in which the government provides the basic services that, you know, everybody needs generously for the working class. And so that arrangement, you know, the socialists said, oh, you know what, we're okay with that. So keep capitalism, but we'll go for this kind of stuff. So it's the socialists that became Keynesian. And conservatives for a while became Keynesian. And so that was the consensus of the 50s and 60s that did work out. But, you know, society is complicated. You know, sometimes you don't just want to be doing well. What you want is to be better than the other guy. And so I think that that's part of what, you know, led to the break of that compromise.
Now, last question I've got for you. You know, I keep hearing people talking about, you know, this summer is going to be the end of humanity, the end of the world, Armageddon's coming, Wall Street's going to crash, your stocks are going, everything, it's all over, Mateus. There's a realignment, it's, you know, the deep state, you know, whatever, however you want to frame it. Are we concerned that the end of the world is coming in the summer?
I'm afraid what they're going to do. Even I'll say this, even if they allow for a default or a shutdown of the government, I don't think we're going to be Greece even. You know, so I don't think we can live 15 years of, you know, below the 20% below the GDP level of, you know, the peak. So what I think the cooler heads in the Republican Party will prevail. What I do think is that they can take a significant sort of price for that, and that might have implications for 2024 for the election. So I think that's a possible scenario. So I think that the Republicans, very dangerously, let's say the party-trained Republicans, they're using the crazy ones to obtain concessions from the government. But those concessions can come with a price that it's very high. Yeah, because we don't know who wins in 2024, and we know I know. Look at Brazil, the copycat, you know, stuff has been very hard. Democracy is in line, and so 2024, we don't know who comes. You know, Ron DeSantis, yeah. Trump himself. So it's very dangerous. We're playing with fire.
There you go, Mateus. I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Check out the website nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com if you want to check out Mateus Venango's writings. Appreciate the time, man.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. You want to take a quick break? Right back. The potty trained ones. I'm stealing that. I am stealing that. Right back after this. Stick around. If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to therickssmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at therickssmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The potty-trained ones. I'm definitely stealing that. Because it's a perfect frame. I mean, again, you look at, you know, today, the shenanigans that went on in the House of Representatives. You know, and of course, you know, They went after Ilhan Omar and they expelled her from her committee, which you knew was going to happen. You know, you knew it was going to happen. They were going to find their reason. And for me, the reality is Democrats had to expect this was going to happen because this is retribution. And it's about the right using this as a tool to raise money. Our politics, you know, our governance anymore with the people who are in charge there, it's not about getting stuff done, because what's gotten done since they got there? Nothing. It's all about feeding the outrage machine. It's all been about, you know, all negative stuff. And now we find that there's a Chinese spy blimp, you know, circling around Montana. You've got this Chinese app, this TikTok, that's infecting our children's brains with this algorithm that just keeps feeding them this poison. And yet we're unable to deal with any of that stuff. Colorado Senator Michael Bennett He evidently wrote to Google and Apple, urging both of them to take TikTok off of the app stores. Because at some point, they're going to have to figure out how to deal with this. Because you have a direct link from the Chinese communist government to our children. But there was no talk of that from House Republicans. Nothing. Because again, they use TikTok. I get their videos. I get their little pieces. And it's poison. And this is where we as a society, we need a better government. We need better people in the House.
Continue the conversation online. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook and on Twitter.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The Pentagon tracking a huge spy balloon from China that's flying over the U.S. A defense official saying they believe the balloon has limited value for intelligence collection. The Northeast about to get hit by an Arctic blast, and Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey is asking residents to be proactive.
I would encourage the public to look after your neighbors. Check on those who are vulnerable, particularly our seniors, but anyone you know who may be vulnerable in this time.
Dangerous wind chills likely. Russian missiles striking residential areas in eastern Ukraine. House lawmakers stripping Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar of her seat on the Foreign Affairs Committee over anti-Semitic comments made in 2019. Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
We're not removing her from other committees. We just do not believe when it comes to foreign affairs, especially the responsibility of that position around the world with the comments that you make. She shouldn't serve there.
This is ABC News.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
From the Civic Media News Desk, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Milwaukee will host a Republican presidential primary debate during the upcoming campaign. That's on top of hosting next year's GOP National Convention. Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel confirmed the choice this afternoon. No word on when it will be. Republican candidates debated in Milwaukee in 2015. There are new vaccination rules in Wisconsin for schools and daycare centers. Starting this month, students have to get a meningitis shot in seventh grade and a booster by their senior year of high school. The Department of Health Services is also moving the whooping cough shot from sixth grade to age 11. Daycare centers now need proof from a doctor about kids' chickenpox history. The chickenpox vaccine is highly recommended but not required. In sports, Marquette beat Villanova last night 73-64. The Bucks host the Clippers tonight. The Badgers are at Ohio State. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Civic Media promised you something big to celebrate our new and still growing network of radio stations. When we announced the one-day $1 million advertising giveaway for Wisconsin businesses, you responded.
Just wanted to echo your sentiments about the advertising. That's really a cool deal and really remarkable.
$1 million of free advertising. Now, if you missed this chance to work with our team, go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. One of our local sales pros will get right back to you. Civicmedia.us and sponsorship.
Go by any construction site in Wisconsin, you're going to see a lot of Michael's trucks. Since 2014, they've had more than $1 billion worth of contracts with the state government.
A large part of those coming with Foxconn without any results in that area.
Do we want a governor who might be giving his brothers the contract? I think he needs to answer that before the election.
We'll just kick that one down the road. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, but of course, Michael's corporation would get to build that said bridge.
Listen, Monday through Friday from 2 to 3, it's Dueling Tangents.
What is dedication?
My daughter started making necklaces. She makes what we call affirmation fashion. I tell her every day that your black is beautiful. And if there's anything better than being beautiful, it's being smart. And if there's anything better than being smart, it's being kind. And reaffirming that every day is our method of making sure her chin never drops.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom. Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Doesn't give a damn about the integrity of elections. He's only clinging to George because his own support in the House is so iffy. that he needs Santos's vote to save his own worthless political hide. This is Jim Hightower saying, Santos is a congenital liar, but McCarthy is a self-serving political hack, and neither one should be in public office.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So hard to believe that it's been 30 years since Bill Clinton signed the Family Medical Leave Act. Something that, you know, and again, it's one of these, man, am I getting old? It's one of these things that, you know, when our union was fighting to get this passed, I helped work on this campaign all those years ago to get not only this passed, because there was nothing before. If you had a loved one who got sick, if you got sick, if you had the birth of a child, any of this stuff, and you needed time off, you were out of luck. So this gave the basis of people to say, no, family values matters. But the paid part of it was just, you know, we couldn't get that through. And it's amazing to me the fact that the people who tell us that they believe so much in family and family values and how much they love the children. Here's an idea. All those people out there fighting to force people to have children. How about we start with making family leave a paid benefit so that we want to bring children into the world? Here's, a start. And here to share some thoughts on the 30th anniversary of the Family Medical Leave Act, I've asked Emily Andrews to come talk with us. She's the director of the Education, Labor, and Worker Justice Program there at the Center for Law and Social Policy. CLASP.org is their website. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. It's wonderful to be here.
So this at the time was a huge victory. And I don't know if you probably don't remember it, but it was an enormous victory at the time for working people to say, look, if we get sick, if I have a loved one who's sick, if we bring children into the world, this gives us a right to spend time with them, which had not been there before. But, you know, it's one of those things where average everyday working people can't afford to take extended periods of time without pay. So while it was a huge victory, it came at a cost, I thought.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I wasn't old enough to be fighting for it, but I am older than paid family medical leave. Yes, it was a watershed moment. It was a huge boon to workers' rights, workers' protection. There was nothing before it. It's an incredibly important piece of legislation. And still to this day, last year alone, 15 million workers took leave under FMLA, and they were able to return to their jobs, and they were able to have health insurance continue while they were on leave. And it's not just the pay. The FMLA itself, even though it is a huge protection for workers, itself is flawed. There's restrictions there, and unfortunately, due to those restrictions about how big the employer, the size of the employer, over how long you've worked for that employer, how many hours you worked in the last year, all of these things can reduce your eligibility for even unpaid leave.
Yeah.
So in this system that we're currently operating under, only 44% of working Americans are ineligible for even unpaid leave protections, which is just criminal.
Yeah, and the thing is, well, again, you go back, this was historic at the time, 30 years ago, and at the time we took what we could get. And I remember the argument being, hey, this is a massive step forward. This is an enormous victory for working people. We're going to get to the next place. At the time, everyone was talking about trying to tie it to unemployment benefits to say, hey, look, you can't work because we'll open it up to unemployment so that people could get at least a little bit of resource to live on. That's over the years hasn't happened. And we were told, you know, all of these other things that weeded people out, we would work towards down the line, like a lot of social programs, you know, like Medicare and Medicaid. We were told that was the analogy we were giving. We'd make it better. We haven't really done that, have we?
No, unfortunately. You know, there's a number of bills just to even prove the number of folks who are covered by FMLA that can't make it across the finish line. And then there's this huge question of the need for paid leave in this country. We are the only industrialized country without paid leave. It's just shocking. And so, of course, you know, the biggest obstacle to taking FMLA is that folks can't afford it. They can't afford to be off work for 12 weeks. Very few workers can afford that. And so that is the next step. And so the anniversary is bittersweet because it was supposed to be a first step. And here we are 30 years later, and we have not taken the next step.
I over my lifetime, I've used it. I think I've used it five times. You know, my ex-wife's parents were terminally ill. I used it incrementally. We were able to use incremental days to take them back and forth to the hospital. When each of my children were born, I have three children. We took I took 6 weeks with two of them, 7 weeks with one, because that's what we could afford. Mm-hmm. Would I have loved to spend all 12 weeks with the children when they came home? Absolutely. But back to that paid component part of it, just couldn't do it. It didn't have the resources to do. Do you find that's what we're seeing people would want like me to take those additional weeks, but the resource just aren't there? Because again, I come back to this. We're told, you know, there are certain, you know, political parties that are family values folks, and that we love the children. And I'm sure you've heard that rhetoric time and time again.
Yes, it does.
This seems like a perfect place to, you know, I don't know, put up or shut up.
I 100% agree. And I don't think it's just that individuals want to take this leave. So many workers need to take this leave. So I'll tell my own leave story. I am a mother, and, you know, even in the best circumstances, childbirth is an incredibly difficult experience. It can leave you battered and bruised, and millions of women have to go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. When I gave birth, 2 weeks, I couldn't even walk upstairs. I couldn't walk upstairs until my third week after postpartum. I couldn't even fathom going back to work, having to drive a car, having to be in an office 8 hours a day, much less having to be on a factory floor, having to be, you know, whatever my job in a service sector job, where I'm on my feet all day, would have been unthinkable. But actually, this is the reality we're living under. And this is the reality that many politicians who claim, exactly as you're saying, to be for, in favor of families, this is the reality that they've left us with.
Yeah, now I go back to my own experience. I've always been a union member. I've always been fortunate enough to be protected by labor union contracts. And I remember the first time I went to use it for the birth of a child, company told me, no, you can't take it. That doesn't cover that. We're not letting you go. You can't have it. And I'm like, I'm going because it's the law, and filed grievances and all this stuff. And my mind, where I'm at now, is I wonder how many people companies are able to bully them into believing that it's not covered, and then they don't get to take it. And again, there's so many of these scenarios where, again, we were told this was going to be improved as we went down the road, that we should be on this anniversary committing that in 30 years from now, we get to the place where we need to be, or in 3 years.
Yes. And even when folks have the right to paid leave, you know, 11 states in the District of Columbia have passed paid leave legislation. And we find one of the top reasons why workers don't take it is because they're fearful of retaliation and losing their jobs. And so even when there is job protection written into this legislation, the power balance of this country still allows employers to, you know, put the fear within workers that they'll lose their jobs. So yes, I think more education is always needed around these bills, and, you know, more enforcement.
And again, I come back to, as I always do when we talk about employment, another reason, another example of why every working person needs to have a union contract to protect them and give them job security on the job, so that they have the ability to stand up for their rights. And this is a working person's right. This was fought for. You know, I remember, you know, phone calls and letters and marching and all kinds of stuff to get this done. This was meant for people to take. This was meant as, well, to help families, and to have, well, these employers be able to bully and harass and intimidate is not what the intention of the law was.
Of course not. And this is why I love this show. There is no better job protection than a union contract. And we've talked before about how excited we are to see this big wave of organizing. We need to see more of it, because union, there's strength in numbers, and union contracts and unions can protect workers.
Now, here's the thing. And now we've been talking about it from the worker's perspective. And look, I'm all about working people getting the best opportunities they can, not just for the work that they do, but for their families and balance life, work balance and all that stuff as well. But this is also good for employers as well, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. We've seen that in states that have passed, you know, for FMLA, most definitely, for paid leave, yes, of course. We've seen in states that have passed paid family leave, there is good returns for businesses. We see turnover drop. We see the women's connection to the labor force be maintained. A lot of times when women have to, or anyone has to leave their job instead of being able to take leave, then that employer needs to hire new staff, needs to train new people. We see reduced turnover when we have both FMLA and paid family leave. We also see a real benefit for small employers when we have paid family leave mandated by the state. So it can be hard for small employers to compete with big businesses who are able to offer these benefits. And so things like a mandate and a state-sponsored paid family leave program really help small businesses compete.
No, and this is where, again, I come back to the unemployment system as a perfect mechanism to do this. It was a good idea back 30 years ago. I think it's a good idea now.
Yeah, I mean, we got to figure it out. One of the, you know, what's before Congress right now is the Family Act. And this has been introduced multiple times. And this is a guaranteed comprehensive paid family leave program. How this would work is it's a payroll tax. There's a small tax on payroll for employees. There's a tax on employers. And so it's really a social insurance system. And the way it breaks down for the tax on employees, the average worker would pay about $2 a week. So it's like a cup of coffee for a guaranteed benefit of paid family leave whenever you need it. So that's really kind of how we're thinking about how to pay for a social insurance paid leave program. Everybody buys in. It's kind of owned by the people, and they get to take it when they need it.
But isn't that what unemployment is? I mean, it's the same exact thing. The employers pay into it. The employees pay into it. It's a social insurance program.
It seems like
if we were to have a conversation around, you know, how we provide a safety net for working people that was much more comprehensive than these Band-Aids and these piecemeal programs, we would come up with a better system. But the problem is we've got so many people who tell us that they believe in family values and they love the children doing these performative things like we saw today in the House of Representatives saying we decry socialism and we'll do nothing, no forms of socialism. And yet, you know, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, public safety laws, worker compensation laws, all of these things have a component of social to them. That completely out of their minds. And this is why we can't have nice things.
That's right. The scary part is there's actually some very damaging Republican proposals. For example, Marco Rubio's got an idea that instead of funding a paid leave program, workers could actually steal from their future Social Security earnings. And so we're talking about really like robbing yourself of a secure retirement in your old age and using that money for paid leave now.
Which is literally the dumbest thing anyone could ever propose. And if you ask any money manager ever, you know, because we just sat down with my kids, you know, my son's 16, my oldest daughter's 20. You know, when they first got their first job, 15 years old, we got them into a Roth IRA and said, you never touch this ever.
Right.
Not until you get to the end. And if you do, I'll come back and I'll beat you myself. To have a policy that says, no, that's okay, is irresponsible on steroids and kind of shows me exactly what they think of working people. Now, I guess last line of questioning I got two lines of questioning. First, the negative, because we were told, and I want to get your thoughts if this is out there. We were told 30 years ago that this would be rife with fraud, abuse, and waste, and people were going to abuse this program like none other. Do you find that working people are abusing this, that they're taking advantage of the good-heartedness of this program and their employers as was predicted back then by a certain political party and the foes of this?
Absolutely not. I don't have the cold hard fraud statistics for you, but I can tell you as both, you know, I was actually a union steward and a union member, and I, you know, helping folks through their FMLA process. This is serious business. This is when folks need, they're in crisis, they need help, they need to take leave to be with their families or to care for themselves. And it's, you know, there's medical certification required, there's all kinds of verification required. So no, we don't see huge fraud with FMLA.
Yeah, again, you hit on a buzzword there that most people probably don't know what is. You said you were a union steward, and this is, again, another reason why I believe people should be have union contracts and be members of unions, because they have people like you who can help them navigate things like family medical leave, like unemployment when times hit. And they don't know all of the angles, and they don't know all of the information. There's a network of help there, and I think that's really important. So last question I've got for you. What do we do from this point? It's great. We've got this anniversary. Recognize the victory that it was, but the commitment forward has got to be, we've got to do better. What should we be doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know the answer. It's organize, organize, organize. But there's some exciting movement. You know, we did... with the Build Back Better legislation that passed the House last year, it was a high watermark for paid leave because it was included in that bill. So we need to hold on to that idea and that victory. We need to push for a guaranteed federal paid leave program. And there's a lot of exciting movement happening in the states. As I mentioned, 11 states in the District of Columbia have already passed a paid leave law that guarantees workers in those states paid leave, and it just keeps rolling. There's, you know, the election in 2022, we saw some Democratic trifectas come into play, and so those states are now thinking about passing paid leave legislation. It's not the perfect solution. It leaves out a lot of states. It particularly leaves out southern states where we know there's a high concentration of workers of color who are not going to get this state paid leave policy because of the Republicans who control those states. And so we really need to keep our eyes on the prize, which is a federal program.
Got a lot of work to do. But again, you know, today, take the victory. But commit to making it better tomorrow, and we will be doing that. Emily, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again real soon.
Would love to. Thanks so much for having me.
Outstanding. Emily Andrews, she is, like I said, the Director of Education, Labor, and Worker Justice at the Center for Law and Social Policy, CLASP.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at their website. Can take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1929, and 3,000 workers in New South Wales, Australia, were locked out of their jobs. Australia was in the midst of the Great Depression. A judge had ruled that the timber industry could increase the work week from 44 hours to 48, while simultaneously lowering the workers' wages. Standing firm in opposition, the workers refused to comply with the mandatory 4-hour increase in work without pay. The company responded by charging in the courts that the workers had gone on strike. This invoked penalties under the 1928 Arbitration Amendment Act. During the strike, women played an important role, holding weekly meetings and gathering food donations from throughout Sydney for the families impacted by the lockout. Women delivered speeches in support of the strikers, harassed scab workers, and held fundraisers to support the cause. Trade unions in the city also supported the strike, holding a rally of 25,000 workers in March. Then, the same judge who had decided on the increase in hours ordered the union to hold a secret ballot vote on the issue of the strike. This marked the first time a secret ballot vote over a strike had occurred in Australia. In a protest demonstration, 3,000 timber workers burned their ballots in defiance. They also burned an effigy of the judge. When the secret vote finally occurred, management's proposals were roundly defeated by a margin of more than 5-1.
In the end, however, it was a losing battle. The ravages of the Great Depression were too much to overcome. After more than 8 weeks on strike, the workers returned to the 48-hour work week. Leaders of the strike faced criminal charges of unlawful conspiracy by violence and threats of violence, but were eventually acquitted by a jury. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So again, it's hard to believe it's been 30 years. And it's been equally hard to believe that we haven't made things better. This is, you know, I go back to, and I remember the argument being, you know, take the win. You know, there's no paid component. Take the win on family medical leave, and we'll get to it. We'll do what they did to Social Security, to Medicare. Really to Medicare, because Medicare, when it first passed, wasn't that great of a benefit. It really wasn't. It was mostly for the very poor. It was, you know, and over the years, people, hey, this isn't bad. We like this. Hey, we should do more of this. Hey, we want more. Yeah, more. And it expanded. They kept, because people wanted more. This didn't happen that way. And a lot of it had to do by the fact that Republicans did a masterful job of blocking it. Corporate pushback was huge. And at the time, the fact that this got pushed through was just incredible. And I remember, you know, our union at the time was pushing for it and, you know, doing some lobbying and doing some stuff around letter writing campaigns and stuff that we did back then. And legislators, you know, telling, you know, the stories of, you know, being just, you know, like no other being lobbied on this issue. Now, understand, you know, 30 years ago, lobbying was nothing like it is today. It wasn't the industry that it is today. The pressure that they felt to stop this was nowhere close to the amount of full-on, you know, coordinated attacks that would happen today. And what's happened over these years is corporate America has gotten a lot smarter. And this is another one of those issues that working people want. You ask anybody who's used it and they're grateful for it. I'm grateful that for the chance to have spent time when our kids were born, to just be there with them in those first days. Whereas before, you went to work the next day. You didn't go to work the day of sometimes. Corporate America has done an amazing job of building an echo chamber of right-wing media outlets and powerful voices of a lobbying arm that is second to none, of a think tank structure that creates, you know, all this chaos and all this stuff, that this propaganda. Because again, you think about today. In the House of Representatives, they said no forms of socialism, none whatsoever, nothing. Would something like the Family Medical Leave Act pass today? Could it happen? And I no. The answer is flat out no. Could any of the things that helped build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization, National Labor Relations Act, Social Security, unemployment, minimum wage, maximum hour laws, could any of those things pass in today's environment? The answer is no, because corporate America has got us by the, you know, the FCC. This is one of those moments where we've got to ask ourselves, when these performative displays, when the children who haven't been potty trained yet have their little fits and need attention and pursue resolutions that have no means, no enforcement, no reason other than the outrage and divide, do we eventually say no? Enough? Do we throw these bums out? Because again, family leave is one of those things that, look, I've talked about it over the years of how I've been fortunate to use it. for 6-7 weeks at a time. It's the most we could afford. Would have loved to go on the 12th. As would just about any working family. This is something that if you're going to talk about family values, if you're going to talk about we want to push children into the world, if you're going to talk about that, you got to have the policies to back it up. And this is one of them. This is a small one. This is a small one. This is a no-brainer. But you know who this benefits? This benefits working people. Because our wealthy folks, you know, the people up at the top, they got it. They've already got these things. The fact that we don't have a maternity policy in this country, shameful. The fact that we don't have paid leave is shameful. We're the laughingstock of the globe.
You're listening to WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green.